All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Hot Dogs and Caviar. This is our inaugural episode, so if we sound a little stilted, I promise we're better chefs than we are radio hosts. My partner is Nate Whiting. My name is Jesse Sutton. We are two chefs from Charleston, South Carolina. We are both currently out of work due to the corona pandemic, and this is what we found to do with our time. We are going to discuss culinary topics high and low. It's right there in the name, Hot Dogs and Caviar. We are big believers in high-end cuisine. We've worked at the Michelin star level. Nate staged overseas. I spent a lot of money in Paris. We have a decent fine dining resume, but we are also, at our very hearts, blue-collar goons who love cheap tacos, stomped-on burgers, and next-morning pizza so much. So this is our avenue to discuss culinary topics. And one way that we are going to try to rope you all into listening again and again is by telling a funny restaurant anecdote every day to start us off. So this is a story about when Nate and I were chefs at The Woodlands, which was, for a time, the best restaurant in the Carolinas, but ultimately a failure because Somerville, South Carolina is a stupid place to put a five-star restaurant. But we did our best, and the food there was, in its heyday, incredibly good. So we had a dish on the menu called a panisse. A panisse is a kind of a chickpea flour polenta cake. You cook chickpea flour into a polenta and then pour it into a pan and let it settle. And then you punch out circles of it. And then you give them a little crisp fry and some olive oil and use those as a vehicle for other stuff. You put like marinated peppers and olives and chickpea salad on top. And it's just like this little Provençal snack. I tell you that just so that, you know, the anecdote makes sense. I had just been promoted to sous chef. So I was the junior sous chef. Nate was the executive sous chef. So he was the guy actually running the kitchen, let's be real. And I was trying to clean the walk-in and really show out and really do my best and show that, you know, I was going to be a good salaried employee. So I'm relabeling everything and I'm throwing away stuff that's spooky. And then I found this half sheet pan full of this dun-colored stuff I could not identify. And it was just labeled in Sharpie in big block letters, just penis. With no label, no initials, just penis. And I was like, I'm a reasonable person. So I'm going to, I mean, the thing is, cooks like labeling stuff, funny stuff. Like if we have rabbit livers, we're definitely going to label it bunny guts. But like, I really had no idea. I was lost. I was like, I got nothing. So I poked my head out into the kitchen and I was like, hey guys, I'm trying here. Can you help me out? What the hell is this? And another one of the sous chefs, Dustin Busby, looked at me and said, that's the panisse. And I was like, panisse, spelled P-E-N-I-S, and just folded his arms and said, naturally.
Yep.
So that's the kind of people that cooks are. Nate, can you corroborate?
Oh, absolutely. Like labeling peanuts, P-E-A-N-U-S.
Right.
Standard operating procedures.
That's how peanuts is spelled. Or like,
you can't. No.
Or like when my sous chef was caught labeling the duck fat by switching the consonants in front of both words. I was like, yes. who did this? And he got all scared. And I was like, no, this is excellent. So that's the kind of thing we think are funny. There's your anecdote of the day. I hope you all thought it was super amusing. And as a result, listen to this podcast for the rest of time. For our inaugural episode, we've talked about a lot of different topics, but we decided to start off with stuff that is eminently accessible. We didn't want to turn anybody off. We can talk to you for 2.5 hours about the proper way to make a foie gras torchon. But at the end of the day, I think only 1% of the probably 19 people that are going to listen to this would have any interest in that. And if you do the math, that's less than one person. So we couldn't afford to start out like that. I mean, we'll bore you all with pedantic fine dining crap later. But for right now, we wanted to start with some really accessible topics that everyone could relate to. So we've decided to open with that pinnacle of American gastronomy, the hamburger. So, and Nate and I have both cooked many hamburgers in our lives. We've both been the chefs of restaurants that featured hamburgers. We've both been forced to put hamburgers on our menu, kicking and screaming. And we've got a lot of opinions. So I'm just going to open with a little bit of an opinion poll and kind of get to know my partner and I. If any of you are interested in more detailed bios on us, you can check out our companion blog, Hot Dogs and Caviar at blogspot.com, where you can find, there's one of the original posts has some brief bios on us to bore you with all the details. And also you'll find cookbook reviews, adapted recipes, Nate going into deep geek territory about things like brisket marinated in shio koji and then smoked on his outdoor smoker, all sorts of fun stuff. So check that out, but never mind, let's get into burgers. So we're going to open with an opinion poll just to let you get to know us both. So Nate, are you prepared for the opinion poll?
Dutifully prepared, sir.
Excellent. All right, so opinion poll, question one. Now, we are not a Charleston-related blog. We're in Charleston. Occasionally, we're going to have Charleston topics, but we're going to try not to bore the people of you that aren't from Charleston. But for a moment, Nate, what's your best burger in town?
Oh, all right. Well, admittedly, I don't get out too much, but...
It's Corona. No one gets out. Let's pretend it's a year ago.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I never did anyways. Now I have a better excuse.
fair enough.
I got to go with either Husk or Felix.
What is it about the Husk burger that turns you on?
I like the thin patties, you know, the how it's, you know, crumbly, but also, you know, it holds together just enough.
It's kind of the platonic ideal of the burger. It's a burger that's not trying to be too much more than a burger, just really, really well made.
Yeah, it's got the right amount of crumble and stability to it. You know, it's really good beefy flavor with a little subtle smoky notes from the bacon they grind into it. Where generally I would be opposed to, but they do it with just enough subtlety. Well, you don't really pick up on it.
The thing is at Husk, that's kind of their thing.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Like they're Charleston's resident lardcore restaurant. There's pork in everything. There's pork in their cornbread. There's pork in their shrimp salad. And it's all awesome. And so even though I, like you, and like I think most chefs in the South with any sense of subtlety, have gotten pretty tired of just pork fat and bacon in and on everything, at Husk, you cannot begrudge them that. That would be like going to Taco Bell and saying, what's with all the Mexican food? Actually, that's a bad example because Taco Bell is about as Mexican as Northern Minnesota. But that's like going to a Megadeth show and saying, you know what? This is fun and all because you guys stopped playing so many awesome guitar solos.
Yeah, this is awfully loud.
This is awfully loud. It's going to see Iron Maiden and complaining that it's too loud. So Husk is what it is, and it's great.
Absolutely.
You also mentioned Felix, and that is good because I agree completely. Felix is my favorite burger. Now, you and I both worked on King Street for a long time.
Yeah.
And do you remember the King Street Burger War where every fine dining restaurant on the block up and down put a burger on their menu?
Every one of them.
Every single one. And we can get into that later because that's a whole different topic. Burger inflation. More on that in a bit. But I thought the Felix one was the best one because it was the one that most resembled just a good grimy bar and grill burger.
Yeah.
Like the smashed flat patties, you know, the bun that was like just griddled in grease and just all kind of just textured and amazing. Just a significant amount of animal fat that you're just crushing and you don't worry about it and you just go for it. And I love that they used raclette, which is, I think, probably one of the most underrated cheeses in the French ensemble. Raclette goes with beef so well. I think it's the ideal cheese for a French onion soup.
And you know what? I agree.
That's kind of what that burger captures. That burger is like eating a big, greasy wad of French onion soup made into a solid. And if people don't think that I'm saying that like it's a good thing, I assure you I am. If you're in Charleston, South Carolina, go to Felix, get the burger, and just do not look back. It's amazing.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's really good. Like, it's not like your quintessential, you know, American cheese and, you know, smash patty, but it's really phenomenal. That raclette, like, sets it off.
And the thing I love about the Felix burger is that you don't feel like you're eating a chef trying to dress a burger up to go out. The burger is unapologetic. It says, this is an American cheeseburger. You got a problem with that? You know what you can do with it. It's just, it stands on its own. It's amazing. All right. Second off, do you have a favorite burger outside of Charleston? A favorite burger in the world?
Favorite burger in the world? No, nothing really like I yearn for or anything that's really like, you know, tugs at the heartstrings too much. What say you?
Well, there's one, and it's funny. We're going to get into this later, the thin burger versus thick burger debate. But this burger's a thick burger, which, spoiler alert, is not absolutely my favorite. But there's this bar in Atlanta called The Vortex. And their burgers, they're all like $20, and they're just gigantic. They're like 3/4 of an inch thick. And they're topped with like crazy toppings. Like the one that I got, I don't know, it was like Atlanta just expressed itself. Fried okra and pimento cheese and hot sauce on a burger. So it was too much toppings and too much beef, too thick a patty. And it was absolutely flawless. But I gotta say, like, I had that restaurant sort of cheated to win me over. Like, you know how sometimes you can have a great restaurant experience and when the food's mediocre but the service is just amazing, you're like, that place was great.
Oh, yeah.
And whereas the same food, if the service sucks, you're like, this place is terrible. Well, at that place, the entire front of their menu was like a 200-word essay on the rules for eating there. And they were fantastic. It was everything I ever wanted to say to a client but couldn't. Like, it was like, point one, absolutely no special orders. Get out of here with that. Except it was much more profane.
And then that's great.
Point two was no one under 21 allowed. It's not that our liquor license requires that. We just don't want kids in here. And I was like, I love this place.
They said what we think.
Exactly. So everybody check out the Vortex if you're ever in Atlanta. I'm giving it a plug. Even though their burgers are stylistically not what I think of as excellent in a burger, they are extremely well executed. The flavors are excellent. But man, their contempt for the customer is a burning beacon of light that every restaurant person in America wishes we could shine. It's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, well said, my friend.
Next question. I think burgers are a very mainstream thing. What's your go-to for a mainstream burger? Like the kind
mainstream?
Of burger you can get anywhere.
I'm a sucker for Five Guys around here. There isn't one around here. I also a big fan of Shake Shack. Those are spectacular burgers.
Never been to a Shake Shack.
Yeah, they're really good. And just that's the quintessential kind of what you think of as an American, you know.
Okay.
Good grind, good cheese, good bun.
Is it super
classic
expensive?
Classic topping. No, it's not. I mean, it's a little pricey, but it's still a burger.
We're fine dining guys. Everything we like is a little pricey. Felix burger is at least $17.
It's not that much.
Oh, you know, I don't know Shake Shack, but I have read Danny Meyer's autobiography. I think it was called something like "I'm Better Than You" by Danny Meyer. Have you read that?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So
is it Setting the Table or?
Setting the Table, that's what it was called. I thought it was I'm Better Than You because it said that on every page. And he spent a long time talking about how Shake Shack was one of the ways in which he was better than us. But having said that, he also seems to run a really tight ship. So I would love to check out the Shake Shack burger.
Definitely worth it.
I'm going to go a little more down market. I think my mainstream burger, and this is me getting into my bio a little bit. Actually, I don't put this in my bio. I got my start at Wendy's. And the thing about Wendy's is that, yes, it's gross. And yes, it's corporate fast food. But they do use actually real ingredients. With one exception, and that's the cheese sauce that they put on fries. That stuff is just Martian vomit. But everything else at that place is pretty good. The burgers are rock solid. And on top of rock solid, that's some of the best food you can get for $3, not at a taco stand.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think like the, you know, ultra-national, coast-to-coast, like fast food places, like Wendy's Burger is pretty solid, Wendy's, especially for the price.
Just for example, Wendy's beats the absolute bricks off McDonald's.
Oh, absolutely. Like Burger,
It's not. And well, Burger King has that like fake grill flavor that they,
Burger King is terrible.
I mean, if I have to, I have to, you know, I am no angel, but Wendy's is a, if I'm going mainstream, I'm going all the way mainstream.
Yeah, and I look for a Wendy's if that's what I'm looking for.
Right. If you're driving on the road and you're in the middle of Indiana and you're like, wow, there's just nothing. You're like, okay, if I can't find a Popeyes, I'll go to Wendy's. That'll work.
Yep, for sure. Definitely agree with you on that.
All right. How about favorite regional chain? Like a chain that hasn't really gone national, but that you think is absolutely just bananas awesome.
Well, mine would be the Western New York classic. It's called Bill Gray's. It's they do, you know, the iconic burger, the thinner patty, the cheese, a really good bun. My favorite thing is they put on the hot sauce, the what Jesse so poignantly coined the Rochester quality assortment plate. We can get into that later, but the hot sauce is not quite Skyline chili, not quite beanless chili,
I think what most Americans would associate that with would be hot dog chili.
Hot dog chili, yeah, but like, spiced with like cinnamon and
right, like it definitely is. It's definitely Greek in origin.
It was invented by a Greek place, Nick Tahoe's in Rochester. Yeah, definitely Greek origin.
Was it the kind of
for over 100 years?
Oh, that sounds. I love a good Rochester garbage plate. Yeah. we'll get into that later. That's Nate's baby, and it's good after drinking food. When you've gotten yourself to the point where you absolutely need 1,500 calories in 3 minutes, that is the way to do it.
That's the way to go, man.
Well, we're going to continue the opinion poll. Most essential burger toppings. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying the ones without which a burger is not complete. And this is a hotly contested issue. So what do you got? What must a burger have to qualify as a good burger in your world?
I mean, essential toppings, brass tacks, like I think yellow mustard, dill pickles, and then even hot sauce, even more for the acidity, let alone the
heat. just to clarify, you're not talking about Rochester hot sauce. You're talking about like...
Right. I'm talking about like Frank's or Crystal's or...
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify because we just introduced the listeners to the term hot sauce a minute ago and...
Splash of Tabasco just for acidity.
I don't disagree with that. On the one hand, I am fancy, so I prefer Dijon mustard. I'm a snob. I'm not ashamed. I got to tip my hat to the dill pickle because sweet pickles are so gross and dill pickles are so amazing. It's like... It's amazing how by just like taking away the turmeric and sugar and adding dill and garlic, you can take something I cannot stand and make it into something I absolutely love.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that.
Having said that, and the thing is there's almost no foods I don't like, but sweet pickles are definitely on the list. Having said that, my ideal burger, I am a super minimalist. My ideal burger is just a salted and peppered burger with a schmear of mayonnaise on the bottom bun. And a thin slice of raw onion on the top.
I'm a big fan of the mayonnaise on the bottom. You want to go into like the science and like why the way it's the way to go, man.
I sure will. And I got to give credit where credit is due. I got all this from Alton Brown. But Alton Brown's burger technique is a schmear of mayonnaise on the bottom bun. And then, you know, when you cook a burger, like, you know, when you cook a tray of burgers, all that juice that's on the tray, the burgers bleed juice. And we actually at the Woodlands used to dip French fries in the burger juice, like fighting over the burger juice after we'd pulled the burger out of the broiler. Like the burger juice was like one of the chef treats, which is a whole different episode that we're definitely going to get to. But
don't judge me.
Yeah, and Nate's not nearly as fat as I am, so obviously, I always won the race. I always won the race to the burger juice. But the idea with the mayonnaise on the bottom bun. Mayonnaise is a stable emulsion. It's got it's a lipid phase dispersed through a water phase. So they say oil and water don't mix, but mayonnaise is one of the places where they do mix. The reason is because of natural emulsifiers in egg yolk, like lecithin. So the idea is when you've got a burger that's dripping out its juice is made of two things, like juicy burger water and burger grease, which are two of the most delicious things in the world, and you don't want to lose them. What the mayonnaise on the bottom bun does is as the burger just kind of gets smeared in there, they give it something to hold on to. It's not a stable emulsion. It won't last long, but it'll last long enough for you to eat your burger. And all that will kind of become this sauce that's just, it's transcendent. It tastes better than burger juice or mayonnaise. They're just two perfect things that go perfect together. And it's just absolutely outstanding.
I like the physical barrier it creates too on the bottom bun, and it kind of helps keep the structure of the bottom bun, because you know you bite it and it's naturally going to flow down. It's going to kind of keep it so you can get through the thing before it turns to like a soggy little postage stamp sized bottom bun, which I hate. You know,
that is a great point, especially with the larger burger.
Yeah,
and if you're eating like a half pound burger somewhere, like if you've gone to the Vortex, which you should because it's great, and you're eating a gigantic burger. If the burger's not well made, then bread's really hygroscopic. All that juice that comes out of there will just soak in there and turn into a sponge. And then all of a sudden your thumbs are pressing through the bottom of the bun and getting to the patty. That's why Guy Fieri flips his burger upside down. I don't have anything else nice to say about him, so let's just drop that. But that's the origin of the upside down burger move, is that you got the heavier bun. But the reason that doesn't work, the reason he's a false prophet, one of the thousand reasons he's a false prophet, is that usually the toppings that are on the top side are like cheese and lettuce, stuff that's watertight. So if it's between the mayonnaise and the burger, you never get that sauce. So the burger on the bottom bun is the ultimate weapon.
Mm-hmm. Just the whole anatomy of a burger and the physiology of it. Like, you got to think how you're going to place where strategically, and the condiments, you got to be strategic with them too, though.
And the thing is, part of the whole trademark of this podcast, our thing, is that we will bring fine dining execution to the most grungy and blue collar of topics. Like there is, if we're talking about, $2 tacos or ways to dress up a frozen pizza, we're still all about the high end execution, the high end technique. And I think burgers, composition matters. A burger is
composition, the anatomy, even the physiology, you know, like the bite size, like, you know, like trying to keep the width to like two fingers so you can actually get a proper bite and the right blend. And like, there was a, I forget the name of the university, somewhere in Denmark, they figured out the exact physiological, I can't even say it, bite size is actually the width of your own two fingers. And that's like the ultimate, like, perfect bite size.
That's fascinating.
For each person, you know, like depending on how thin, you know. That's,
oh, so like a little person has smaller hands.
Right.
Yeah.
That's like optimum bite matrix, if you will.
Okay.
You know, and that's taking into like the olfactory gland and like the way the air and the,
wow,
you take a breath in, and it was high tech.
All right, listeners, on the blog, if we can find it, we'll link that. If we can find like a link that we're allowed to use, we will totally put that on the blog because that is fascinating. It yeah. also makes me think that a lot of the burger places in the world right now that are trying to trade on being excellent burgers have burgers that are shack sized.
Yes. I'm not a boa. I can't unhinge my jaw. It wasn't in a horrible, you know, boxing accident where, you know, Mike Tyson knocked my mouth loose.
What you're saying is if Shaquille O'Neal and the Great Khali and the Big Show walked into a bar and they had 10-ounce burgers with huge buns, they would be fine.
Yeah.
Whereas Nate and I always look like we've, you know, tried to use our face as a garbage disposal at the end of it.
I mean, I'm not saying I won't mash my face into one, but it's not ideal.
A giant burger is, as we will discuss, perhaps not the ideal, but I will definitely, absolutely still crush one right
oh,
now.
Yeah.
On to the continuum of the opinion poll. How about your favorite oddball burger topping? You ever had anything on a burger that was just plain weird, but like still strangely good?
Not that I can think of. Nothing really jumps to mind.
And like I said, I'm a minimalist, but the reason I put this question on the opinion poll was so that I could tell you this trick. You know when you get Mongolian beef from the crappy Chinese place?
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's like peppers and onions and like a spicy brown sauce with just chunks of, I don't know what cut they use. Like, I'm sure they say it's round, but it's probably, I don't know, wrist or something. And so you eat half of it, but you can't eat all of it because Chinese portions are crazy. And then you put the rest in your fridge, and then you get drunk and pick out all the beef and eat it, and then you fall back asleep. And then the next day you've got this, like, the other half of your Mongolian beef, and you were like, oh, man. And then you want to blame someone else, but, you know, you're like, well, my wife,
focus.
My wife certainly didn't do that, and my dog doesn't have thumbs. What I've discovered is if you just make a burger, if you have some ground beef and a bun in your house, and you make a burger and then take all that extra slop from the Mongolian beef and use that as a burger topping with a squirt of sriracha, it's just absolutely
Ooh,
outstanding.
That sounds fantastic.
It is. It's one of the best ways to repurpose leftovers, and especially good if you're the kind of person that picks over your leftovers drunk and picks all the meat out.
Yeah, I'm more of a minimalist, you know, like when we were talking about essential toppings, like mustard, pickle, a little hot sauce, like that's all I need. It's not to say that I don't love ketchup and mayonnaise. Like
I was actually going to say, it's interesting.
I love that stuff. It's just, if we're really stripping it down, like I don't even think a good burger needs cheese.
Oh, absolutely. That's a whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You've touched on two interesting things, and I think there were
not that I don't love cheese. I want cheese on my burger. It's just I don't think it has to have it if it's a great burger.
Well, let's just get into that because I totally agree. I feel like Jeffrey Steingarten wrote an article about apple pie. And the quote that he used was, "Promiscuous use of cinnamon has made us forget the taste of apple." And he was talking about how French apple tarts have a great flavor. The French do not use a lot of cinnamon. If they do use it, they don't use it in desserts. They'll use it if they're doing like Moroccan food. So he was saying that like Americans just load their apple tarts with cinnamon and don't know what apple tastes like anymore. And his piece of evidence that he used was Ritz Cracker used to put out like a Depression era recipe for Ritz apple pie. That was a mock apple pie that used crunched up Ritz crackers, sugar, and butter with cinnamon as the filling. And the recipe was like, people don't know it's apple pie. And he tried this out. He told some people it was apple pie and not everybody called him on it. You know, and I feel like I feel the same thing has kind of happened with cheese on burgers. Promiscuous use of cheese has made us forget the ground beef. Now, I don't want to come off like a cheese-hating snob. I love cheese. I'm not saying I'm like too good for a cheeseburger. In fact, if you gave me a cheeseburger right now, I would high-five you. But the idea, there are some people that if you mention a burger and say that you want it without cheese, they'll get mad. Like if you have burger night at your house and you have your friends come over for burgers and you don't have cheese, there are going to be people that look at you like you're denying their birthright.
Oh, absolutely. They're going to hate you.
There are going to be people that look at you like diners look at you when you want them to order their food before they get bread.
You're so right. And cheese, though, it literally masks and can cover up so many mistakes, or
which is actually
inferior meat. Like,
which is a good thing.
It's good. Absolutely. I don't want to taste the McDonald's
hamburgers
meat
out there.
Yeah, I don't want to taste the meat.
The world is full of awful hamburgers, and it's kind of good that the cheese is there. You know, like,
oh, absolutely.
An American cheese is like objectively the worst cheese on earth, but it's still pretty good on a burger.
Yeah. Perfectly good on a burger. No one in their right mind, unless you're like 3 years old, would eat a slice of it.
I mean, it has its applications, but like just eating out of hand is definitely not one of them. But on the other hand, if a burger has a really, it's ground well, it's sourced well, it's seasoned and it's cooked right, cheese is like a bonus. It's not required to make the burger perfect. I think people that think they don't like hamburgers just haven't had a perfect burger.
Exactly. Yeah, they just need to continue the quest.
You said something interesting about when you mentioned cheese, you also mentioned ketchup. And I don't disagree. A burger doesn't need ketchup. What absolutely needs ketchup is the fries.
Like, I agree.
And that's actually something that gets to me about higher end places. Is, have you ever been to a restaurant that thinks they're too good for ketchup?
Oh, yeah.
And like,
for sure. I've worked there. I've eaten there.
There's one person I used to work for that refused to buy it, and I would have to go into the corner store and buy ketchup, and he just roll his eyes, and I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, we serve people French fries. They're going to be annoyed if they don't have ketchup. And I'm talking, if I don't care if I'm getting like French fries in a serious fine dining restaurant, if it's in the U.S., ketchup just goes with fries.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it has to. There's other good things that go with fries. I love chili cheese fries. French fries and mayonnaise is like strangely awesome. And not strangely.
Kewpie.
French fries and Kewpie is even better. But ketchup is just essential on a fry. There's something that it does to it. Like, it's the French fry is such a mild flavor. There's so much bombast. It's got salt. It's got grease. It's got texture. But the flavor is one dimensional. And once you dip it into cold ketchup and get that ketchup plus fried crispy harmony, it
transcends. Beautiful. Different textures and temperatures and acid and creaminess from the nice fluffiness on the inside of the fries, salty, greasy awesomeness.
Now, what I'm going to do right now is underhand you one. That is because I already know your opinion on this. What is your opinion of restaurants that try to make their own ketchup?
How can I put this? It's largely a waste of time. Like, focus your efforts elsewhere. Like, why bother? Like that's not what people want.
I mean, Heinz is unbeatable.
Yeah, you just buy Heinz and then squirt some sriracha in it.
Like,
do something different.
And I get it. The Chez Panisse, that's another thing. You can add things to ketchup and make them great. Like a little scoop of mayonnaise or some truffle oil or...
Truffle oil French fries are freaking awesome.
You know what I want to try? Ketchup and anchovy juice.
Yes.
That would be bananas. I get it. The Chez Panisse revolution was like all of a sudden America had been eating everything out of the freezer and everything out of a box. And then, you know, Chez Panisse comes along and they start making everything by hand, all the California revolution. And I get it. I get where it all came from. But I haven't tasted homemade ketchup yet that didn't suck.
Yeah, that's just, I've never had a good one. And I've tried, I've made my own. I've been a part of many trials and it's not worth it. The worth your time. It's not worth the effort. It's just never more than just okay. And then you're in a restaurant and you know, your number one job is to please the guests and they want Heinz ketchup. That's what they want. Hidden Valley Ranch dressing. They don't want your ranch. They want Hidden Valley Ranch.
That is actually, this is going to be a bit of a digression, but that's depressingly true.
That's what they want. That's what people want. That's what they know.
I am a known ranch hater, but, but all, on the other hand, there are people that are going to demand it and you can break your balls and waste an hour shaving garlic and chopping dill.
Or you chives can, and get all fresh and green. Yeah.
Or you can keep some of the Hidden Valley powder around and throw it into some mayonnaise, thin it with some buttermilk and send out the ranch to the people that want it. And they get what they want. And
that's what they want.
You're done in 2 seconds.
Yeah. That's what they want. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine.
There's nothing wrong with that. Although it did annoy me when I worked at a pizza place and people would like freak out if they didn't have ranch with their pizza. Now, I get this is, I'm going to sound like a hypocrite because I just got done saying that if you freak out if you don't have ketchup with your French fries, that's valid. But if you freak out, so
this is completely different.
Totally. This is a different ball game. God damn it. who decided that ranch and pizza was going to be okay? Like, that's just barbarism. Although on the other hand, I'm going to give these people the benefit of the doubt for a moment because we are an egalitarian podcast. We're hot dogs and caviar, not hot dogs. I will say that perhaps the people that can't fathom pizza crust without ranch also are in that boat because they, for the same reason that people can't fathom a burger without cheese, and that's just that they've never had perfect pizza crust.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe if all you've ever had is Little Caesars, so you're like, well, I'm done with the topping, but I still have this crappy chunk of bread. What can I dip it in? And so maybe that's how the ranch thing happened.
Oh, absolutely. There are way, way more inferior pizza doughs than there are good ones. Just like burger patties. There's so many just smeared pink kind of overground patties to make sure you don't see any fat in it at the grocery store to freak people out.
That's a fine point.
You know, it looks like pink paste.
So I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt. It's possible that people that are obsessed with ranch on pizza have not had proper pizza crust. And also don't go to Papa John's where they give you that little cup of garlic goo, which is, to my mind, every bit is disgusting, but also better than ranch. Like if you're going to eat something that's disgusting and fatty and full of fake garlic flavor, I say go with Whirl.
Yeah, go with the Whirl, like the Whirl Banya Cauda.
It's true. Whirl
at least that makes a little more sense.
Whirl is right. At least Whirl is pretending to be Italian, just like Little Caesars. Well, that's
at least
that's
they tried.
Yeah. So okay, but point is that I'm still being beneficent. I'm giving people the benefit of the doubt. It's possible that they just haven't had great pizza. It's also possible that they're all barbarian hillbillies. So I think we need to allow for that possibility too.
All very real possibilities. But, you know, none of them's wrong, you know. Hey, do you, man.
What is your most overrated burger topping?
Well, I got to go with fresh tomatoes.
Oh, my God.
Fresh tomatoes almost always suck. They almost always cost more than the meat themselves, and they still suck. There's just so many problems. Like you can't even get a good fresh tomato 99% of the year. And when they do, I don't want to put it on a burger. I want to, you know,
highlight
the tomato.
Slice it thin and put
even
it on
if
a
you
plate.
Slice it thin.
And
yeah.
Drizzle it with olive oil and fleur de sel and cracked black pepper. And then just eat it with a fork like a grown-up. I agree 100%. And another thing that I agree with is put a tomato on a burger. All you're bringing is moisture and cold. You're making your burger cold and wet, which are two things that no one wants their burger to be, and yet people freak out if there's no tomatoes.
Yeah, I know. They're all mad that they don't have a half-green, watery,
mealy,
flavorless, mealy freaking tomato on their burger. It's like, ugh.
I think that came out of my theory, and this is, by the way, corroborated by nothing, is that the whole thing about lettuce and tomatoes on burgers came out of just delis having lettuce and tomatoes around for club sandwiches and BLTs, where both of which are good with tomato. Kind of need tomato. And so when they did a burger that is a burger with everything just became the same thing that went on a sandwich with everything, which is, you know, just all the stuff we have. Then people got just obsessed with it. A tomato brings nothing to a burger.
I agree. Even a perfect tomato, it's like, I kind of feel like you could leave it off. I mean, some people like with the cheese though, like how dare you not have a burger without a slice of tomato on it?
I think a good way of thinking about it is that a perfect burger doesn't deserve to have a tomato done to it. And a perfect tomato doesn't deserve to have a burger done to it.
Beautiful. Yeah, I agree with that. And I once read an article too, just even the economics of it, like they're so expensive. They cost more than beef half the time. And I read an article about how McDonald's, how they've made so much money over the years is they don't use fresh tomatoes. That's one of the biggest reasons why
their standard
the most economically viable fast food chains.
Yeah, their standard burgers. I mean, I think they have tomatoes around for them.
I think they just started with their deluxe or
they have
their premium line or whatever.
Back in the day, they had the McDLT, but like the tomato was something you had to have extra for. Their base burgers come with none of that.
None.
And McDonald's, man, they may not make the best burger in the world, but they're good at making money.
Yes, they are.
All right, the last question on my opinion poll. What is your favorite burger-ish recipe? That is to say, something that involves a patty, but is not exactly like a standard hamburger. And I'm going to throw this open to you because I'm positive what you're going to say.
it's got to be the garbage plate, even though you can't call it a garbage plate. You can get sued. It's a trademark name. Yeah, they trademarked that. Yeah, it's crazy.
Even though
every place in Western New York has their own version of it, especially in the Rochester area.
How about trash plate? Does trash plate work?
Yeah, you can call them trash plates. I don't think that's trademarked, even though like some places have like their... you know, their shtick or whatever, they might come after you.
It does stand to reason. That's why I was very careful when I was editing your tater tot article. I was like...
Exactly. Tater tots, registered trademark.
Potato barrels. Oh my God.
Yeah. Crazy.
So yeah, that's an interesting side note that I had no idea. But yeah, man, get back into it.
The garbage plate. It's essentially a base of macaroni salad, home fries, baked beans... pick one or a combination of all three. Then you can take cheeseburgers or hot dogs. You set those right on top of the base and you pour the hot sauce on top of it. Like we were talking about earlier, kind of like hot dog chili with like some cinnamon and little spices in there, a little zesty, a little sweet kind of, I don't know how did you describe that? Like
I said, it was like hot dog chili with more cinnamon.
Yeah. We'll put the recipe up. I'll put my recipe up on the blog.
Yeah.
People can make it. It's awesome. It's great on hot dogs and burgers. And
so again, find Nate Whiting's garbage plate. I'm sorry, we're not going to call it that. We're going to call it what I named it, the Rochester quality assortment.
The Rochester quality assortment plate.
We'll put a recipe up for that on hotdogsandcaviar.blogspot.com. And you can check it out and just make it for people that have been drinking. I cannot overstate the importance of that.
Oh, yeah. It's great drunk food.
I mean, for me, I associate it forever. I've never been to Rochester. So for me, the Rochester quality assortment is all about your Super Bowl party. I've been to a couple, and the Rochester quality assortment, that was served at the one that I remember. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, it kind of sobers you up a little bit.
So you've got like a pound and a half of food in your stomach. You're like, oh God, I'm going to die.
And then the key is the sauce is what really makes it. And then it just kind of comes all into one.
I would never in a million years think to put hot dog chili on top of macaroni salad, but it's strangely bewitching.
Oh yeah. It's and it's definitely a regional thing for sure.
Yeah. There is actually one place in Charleston that at least used to have one. They did one at the brunch menu at the Moose.
Oh really?
Yeah. I ate it once.
Good on them.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's not a good brunch dish.
No.
Like it's a 4 a.m. dish. Like I get what they were thinking. Like it's like, you know, people are doing a hangover soak, but like I ate the Rochester quality assortment. Now I think they just called it a trash plate. But I ate it, and I wanted to die. I'm not saying it's bad. I love the tattooed moose. That was not a dig. But that is not the kind of food you want to eat at, like, 1 in the afternoon.
No.
Your day is over. All right, well, my favorite burger-ish dish, I have two, and I have a hard time deciding between them. And the reason I couldn't is that one of them is still very much a burger. It's still a burger sandwich. But it's non-burger-like enough that I feel like it merits inclusion. And that is... the grungy diner standby, the patty melt, which, in case you've never been to a grungy diner, is a burger patty on a grilled cheese sandwich on rye with grilled onions. And the outside is buttered before it's put on the grill. So you're getting like fat from the burger, fat from the cheese, fat from the butter on the outside, plus fat from whatever they grilled the onions in. Because by grilled, of course, I mean sauteed, because that's what grilled onions means at a diner.
Yep.
And it is... a transcendently fantastic sandwich. You have to eat it in 2 minutes because if they get cold, they're terrible and they get soggy real fast. But the patty melt is my go-to for if I'm going to have a burger patty in a non-burger setting, that's what I want.
Oh yeah. I love a patty melt. It's one of my favorite things. It reminds me of my childhood working in a diner like that. My dad does this trick where he takes the patties and puts them on there and then puts mustard on it and then flips it and sears the mustard into the burger.
Dude, that is
killer.
Bananas. I'm going to break form for a minute. In-N-Out Burger. You been to one of those?
No, I've never been to one.
It's good. It's just okay. Like it's a burger. And the thing is, I know their thing is the secret menu. But here's the problem. I've spent my entire life working in restaurants. And people that make special orders makes me want to like release bees into their car. And like, so to me, the whole thing about a secret menu feels like I'm ordering off menu. I'm worried that the kid that's working behind the counter is going to be like, oh, another one of these D-bags. So I couldn't do it. I couldn't make myself, even though that's their thing. You can go on a whole webpage and learn their secret menu. I was just like, I can't do it. I don't want to feel like that. So I didn't get one. And I realized I didn't give them a fair shake, but if they wanted their menu to be ordered from, they should print it. So I'm done with In-N-Out Burger. But having said that, their legendary burger, that's so legendary I shouldn't have been a sissy about ordering it, is the animal-style burger. And that's what they do. They smear burger on the patty, the mustard on the patty before they sear it, and the mustard's seared up. I'd never heard of that, so you're actually one of the only people that I've talked to that's really had that.
Oh, yeah. I love doing that at the house or whatever. Like, that's so good.
A non-traditional, but certainly not unwelcome. Not unwelcome.
Just a little tinge of acid, but that mustard really like cuts the creaminess and all the fat. And, oh, man, it's so good. I'm going to make one.
me too. I'm definitely going to, we'll do a blog post about this because I want to try the mustard seared beef. But my other go-to for the non-burger burger dish is actually something I only discovered recently. It's a Hawaiian dish called a loco moco. And what it is...
Not familiar.
It's a burger, and at least the one that I had tasted like it had that... I'm not a big fan of the French onion soup mix in burger, but it feels like they did that. And you get something that's Salisbury steak-like. It's not really a burger anymore. But it's okay. This wasn't a burger dish. It's a patty, like a Salisbury steak patty, grilled, and then topped with a thin layer of beef gravy. And served on a big pile of sticky rice with a fried egg on top.
Oh, man.
Which I think is Hawaii in a nutshell, because there's obviously...
Is that a Hawaiian trash plate?
It's a Hawaiian trash plate. It's a... it's funny because it has, like, Japanese minimalism in the sense that there's, like, only a few flavors and then the use of the runny egg yolk and the use of the sticky rice. But that dish is still just as American as it gets.
Oh, yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, if you have a chance to check out a loco moco, they don't have it at a lot of restaurants. Here in Charleston, they have one at Wiki Wiki Sandbar. If you're in other places, I think Hawaii might be the place to try one. But yeah, if you want to eat a burger on top of sticky rice with a fried egg on top, just know that no matter how stoned or hungover you are, there's cultural context for that. So it's okay. The next thing we're going to get to is actually the reason why we wanted to have this episode. And that is, let's talk about the virtues of the smashed flat burger versus the thick burger. Let's talk about burger topping inflation. Let's talk about the fine dining burger and the fine dining burger boom and the hopefully coming soon fine dining burger bust and just whether or not burgers are acceptable fine dining food. Because I know you got a lot of opinions on this. I got a lot of opinions on this. Why don't you give me a brief history of you and burgers and fine dining?
Burgers and fine dining, man, that's just such a slippery slope. You want to be able to put a burger on your menu where it fits the rest of your food and the rest of your style and the dining room and make it delicious, but also not stick out like a sore thumb, right? You want to have a burger that fits everything, but you don't want it to cannibalize the rest of your menu either. That's all you're selling is burgers.
Oh, that's the biggest problem. And I'm just going to take a second on that. Menu mix.
And it's not that burgers aren't awesome. No, sometimes burgers, they're too awesome.
Burgers are awesome. But what happens is occasionally, and by occasionally, I mean frequently, restaurants are owned by people that don't know how to dine. They just want to have a restaurant and they just want to dump a bunch of their money into a garbage disposal. And I'm okay with that because I got some of that money. But they don't know how to dine and they think, if I don't have a burger, we're not a real restaurant. I love burgers. Why can't we have burgers? And the problem really is economics. And that's because you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You either make the burger match the rest of your menu. Like, let's just hypothetically, the rest of your menu has a $45 lamb rack and a $35 lobster and a $30 piece of grouper and a $32 New York strip steak. And then you got a burger. What do you price your burger at? The trouble with menu mix is that the cheaper stuff especially sells. And the one exception is vegetarian plates. A lot of people want meat with their dinner, but the cheaper stuff moves. So if you give people an option, if you price your burger like a reasonable burger, you know, $12, That's literally the only thing you're going to sell.
Yeah.
And
most people just go for the price.
All that lobster's going in the trash because it's just not going to move. A burger is a poison pill on a menu. And then if you decide to do what some places have done and really put a lot of effort into the burger and make it crazy awesome, then you run the risk of charging someone, you know, $38 for something that no matter what fancy ingredients are in it, that's a $38 hamburger. There are places I know that have made a name for doing that. I mean, I've read about Danielle's Burger in New York a million times. It's got short ribs in it, and it's got
foie gras center, the gelée.
It's a $100 burger. But honestly, if I went to Danielle, I wouldn't disrespect him by ordering the burger.
Mm-hmm.
I would get, you know, the tasting menu or whatever on the menu really looked like he put his heart in it. I can't believe his heart's in that burger. Yeah. I can't believe it.
It's just the economics of it. And it's, you still want it to be good, but not too good. You don't want it to be outprice you. You don't want to underprice it.
And
it's really tricky.
It also moves you into the area of size inflation. Like the burger gets bigger and bigger. Cause you, even if you only charge $18 for it, charge me $18 for a burger. It better be gigantic.
Yep.
And then you get into the soggy bottom bun. You get
10
into
10-ounce burgers.
10-ounce burger, that's insane.
And they take forever to cook.
And they're hard
They're
to
hard
cook.
To cook evenly and perfectly. And like, everything is up in the past ready, and the burger is still not quite.
I mean, I remember there were days at the Woodlands where one person would be capable of putting out breakfast and lunch by themselves, just destroying, and then get laid low by burger temping. Like,
yep.
Very, very competent cooks. It's hard to stick medium on a 10-ounce burger.
It's really hard to do.
It's
really small windowed. I mean, to do it correctly.
Burger sizes have gone crazy.
Yes.
They've gone crazy. A burger does not need to be a half a pound. A burger, like a half-pound burger, I'm glad they exist, but a half-pound burger is like a prank burger. That's like, I can't believe I'm going to eat this burger. And now all burgers seem to be a half pound, at least all burgers at nice restaurants.
Give me 2 4-ounce patties. I'll take that all day.
I'd rather have 2 3-ounce patties. At least I can eat that and not feel like I swallowed a grenade. And that's why I want to sing the praises of the underrated smashed flat burger. You know, the thin burger, the opposite of the thick burger. Because on the one hand, it's kind of a thumb in the eye of the sort of fine dining burger wave. That's like, you know, it's just a burger. Just eat it. Also, it takes away taking temps. Because taking temps on burger is enormously frustrating for the cook. And also, I think that I would be remiss in not saying that I've eaten a lot of medium rare burgers, but ground beef is definitely where the serious foodborne illness lives. That and raw lettuce, but there's not much you can do about raw lettuce. The terrifying types of E. coli, they come from ground beef. So all these medium rare burgers, if you're a human and you eat a burger or two a month, you're probably not endangering yourself. It's a numbers game. If you're eating a couple of burgers a month, you're going to be okay. But if you're a restaurant and you're serving 500 burgers a month, all of a sudden, that one half of 1%, that starts to be a real number. At the end of the year, at the end of 10 years, that's no joke. The smash burger sort of takes that, you know, landmine out of the equation.
Yeah, it mitigates your risk a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, on the one hand, let's not kill people, but on the other hand, let's not get sued into dust. Whereas a smash burger, your servers like it better because they don't have to worry about a temp. Your
cooks like it better too.
Because it takes 2 minutes and your diners are fine with it. You can have a deliciously juicy burger that's flat as a goddamn pancake.
Yep, totally agree. And then a lot of that, the size of the grind, like all that'll matter and factor into like how juicy it is. But you can go paper thin and still be delicious.
This is a sea change with me. In the last 15 years, I've completely changed my opinion on burgers. And I think the reason is, you know, when I was in cooking school, you know, when you're in cooking school and you start to see that like people have like raw things and rare things, and that seems like ultra sophisticated. So that's all you want to do. That's all you, it's like, oh, I can't believe they want their steak well done. And now I'm 40 and I've been in the business since I was, you know, 12. And I'm like, I don't care how you want your steak done. I will do whatever. That attitude continues on to burgers. I no longer wrinkle my nose at a well-done burger. And that has allowed me to rediscover the glories of the thin burger.
Yes.
Like all those fast food burgers you learned to love when you were a kid, they didn't suck. They were
No.
great.
Yeah, and it's not that I'll even wrinkle my nose at the well-done burger these days. It's like,
I mean, the thing that makes me wrinkle my nose about a well-done burger today is, well, that's going to be 25 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Like, oh, man, you better get that burger going. Don't drop that pasta yet.
And the reason is because the American restaurant and economics of the big burger boom have forced you to make that burger a half a pound, which is a nonsensical size
Yeah.
for a burger.
Guys like me had to church him up and get all crazy with the toppings and unique and esoteric and just to make them try to fit in.
Right.
And make it look like it's worth $27.
Which of course it isn't. I don't care how much it is, how good it is. It's just a burger.
I don't care if you ground it yourself or did the Blumenthal method and you keep all the grains perfectly aligned,
okay,
laying
now
them down.
That trick is really sick.
It's an awesome trick, but it's a ton of work, and most people it is just lost on.
To clarify what Dave's talking about, Heston Blumenthal, 3-star Michelin chef from the UK, has a series of, I think it's a TV series and a book series called...
Yep, Search of Perfection.
In Search of Perfection. First off, great reads. Check them out.
TV
it's like,
show, too.
Yep. It's like a 250-page book with 8 recipes in it. And mm-hmm. he goes into really basic stuff and shows the absolute perfect way to do it. But perfect doesn't mean practical. You know,
bingo.
If you want to take 3.5 days to make a steak, then go for his method. Or if you want to make, you know, if you want to make spaghetti bolognese that takes you literally 50 hours, then by all means, go with the Heston Blumenthal. But some of the tricks in there are just fantastic. And what Nate's talking about is, you know, when you grind meat, like the worms come out of the dye, and so it looks like a bunch of little squid, like a bunch of little squid tentacles. He's talking about when you do that, you leave them all lengthwise and then lay them onto plastic wrap. And then, you know, layering and layering and layering, and then roll the whole thing up in a sausage and then slice it. As you bite down, all the grains of the meat are going vertical through the round pucks of meat that you've cut off. And it's just the perfect burger texture. It's the absolute perfect burger texture.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But, you know, the average Joe Schmo, they don't care. They want to know why their burger is $27.
Exactly. And once again, this is like, these aren't the people we need to be bending over backwards to please. These are people that came to our fine dining restaurant and ordered a burger.
Yes.
Like, they are not our clientele. I'm not against it. If you want to order a burger at a fine dining restaurant, that's fine. Just understand that if the chef put all of his effort into that, it would be even more money than it already is.
Not even fine dining. Like, what are your thoughts on burgers at a bistro?
I think they're less out of place at a bistro, but I wouldn't do one. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is, especially in America, bistros tend more towards the nice dinner out place. Like, I went to plenty of bistros in France where, like, le hot dog was, like, one of the lunch items. That was also the kind of bistro where everything on the menu was, like, between 8 and 11 euros. Like, it was definitely, like, a cheap restaurant. But in the U.S., the bistro brings a perception of cosmopolitan food. And there are great French sandwiches. You could offer a croque madame, or you could offer a merguez frite sandwich. You ever heard of a merguez frite sandwich?
No, it sounds amazing.
It's a soft baguette. It's called pain bâtard. It's like, which means bastard bread. And I guess that's because it doesn't have the right texture. So it's more of a crackly on the outside, soft on the inside bun. It's one of those split with 2 merguezes, which is like a spicy Moroccan mutton sausage. And then they smear a big thing of mayo down the side and then a big thing of harissa, and they top it with French fries and wrap it in a newspaper.
Oh, nice.
So the thing is, if you're going to make a bistro, celebrate French sandwiches. The burger is very, very, very much an American thing.
Absolutely.
And if you put French Absolutely. Cheese on a burger, that doesn't make it French.
That's true.
No disrespect to Felix, which we both agreed was one of our favorites, which is a French bistro that serves burgers.
But with French cheese on it, but
it does.
You'll have to figure that out on your own.
Yeah, but you know what? It's a great burger. Don't worry about us. So yeah, we've talked a lot about burger size. But the other trend I wanted to address, topping inflation. Burger toppings have been getting a little crazy. Nate, what do you think about this?
Kind of over the top.
I mean, I know that a lot of places are trying to make their burger worth the $25 you're paying.
And
for.
I get it. I was one of those guys. Jesse's been one of those guys. It's hard.
I mean, you're like putting slabs of grilled pork belly on a burger. And the thing is, there was a time in my life where those overtop burger toppings, they really resonated with me because, I don't know, because sometimes too much is just enough. And there's nothing wrong with that attitude. I feel like with something as elemental as a burger, we've gotten away from what a burger is. A burger is a blue-collar thing. It's the kind of thing that you just go and snack on. It shouldn't be half your paycheck.
I agree.
So this topping inflation of like, oh, let's have foie gras. Oh, let's have pork belly. The burger over-the-top topping inflation thing also happens at cheap places. Like, I don't remember where. I think it might have been Hardee's. They had a Philly cheesesteak burger. You'd think that would just be like, you know, grilled peppers and onions plus some Swiss on top of a burger. But this actually had like thinly shaved grilled like round steak on it as well. So it was a burger topped with all of the toppings of a Philly cheesesteak. And that led me to this rule of thumb. If a burger has so much stuff on it that if you removed the burger patty, it would still be a pretty good sandwich, then you've probably crossed the line. You've probably made a burger that did not need to be made.
Yeah, I think that's a really good generalization. But with every rule of thumb, there's exceptions like the patty melt. But like if you can take right. off your burger and still have a Philly cheesesteak sandwich, yeah.
I think that at the end of the day, there's something to be said for addition by subtraction.
Yes.
I call it the Coco Chanel principle. Coco Chanel said, she was talking about fashion, not food, but she said, before you go to a party, look in the mirror and take one thing off. I feel like with a fine dining plate, you definitely have to look at that. Like, does everything on this plate absolutely contribute? Does everything on here need to be here?
Especially now that, you know, you get older, you're younger, you want to do more and more and more and more. Almost always the most important thing you do to a dish or a burger or anything is what you don't do is more important than what you do.
So let's talk about other chef tricks. What do you got as far as like little things to make a burger awesome? Now that we've already given honorable mention to the incredibly amazing but totally impractical and not worth it Heston Blumenthal move.
A couple of chef tricks, like I love the yellow mustard sear into the patty. That's a killer trick.
I have to try that.
I really like adding fish sauce to the actual grind, like about 2-3%. It really kind of mimics the flavor of like dry aged beef, you know, and beef ages, it kind of, you know, intensifies the flavor as the moisture goes out. Well, you can add a little bit of the fish sauce to it.
That is bananas.
Yeah, it's so good.
I cannot wait to try that. Similarly, this is not quite the same thing. I like throwing some minced up anchovies into the burger mix.
Ooh, that sounds phenomenal.
I also am known as a bit of an anchovy fan. I'm sure that's I'm sure that's not a surprise, but anchovies in your burger mix is an excellent move. What else you got?
Really like the portioning with the deli lids too. That's a pretty good restaurant hack trick.
I've actually never seen that.
You just take two deli lids and flip them over and you just kind of mush them together. And it kind of makes like these beautiful little pucks, especially if you're not going too big. Like ideal burger size for me, I'd say anywhere between 5 to 5.3, like 5.3 ounce burger, 150 gram. That's like my ideal patty size. What about you?
A psycho. No, that sounds good. I just never thought about it. But yeah, deli container. So if you get like, you know, chicken salad at a deli, or if you get a hot and sour soup at a Chinese restaurant, what they'd say is take those two lids and smash some beef between them, and it comes out a good size for a flat burger.
Yeah, it's perfect size and it's like all even. And
burgers, if you're going to do a flat burger, then forming them to the patty can sometimes be a challenge. Mm-hmm. Like it's easier to make a thick burger with your hands. With a thin burger, it's hard because you get points where you press a little hard and then you get a part that's too thin.
And you don't want to smear it.
It's a great trick and it's so simple. You talk about shaping. I have actually seen one trick that I've never tried. Have you seen how they do burgers at Steak and Shake?
No.
If you sit at the counter, which you don't necessarily want to do because you don't necessarily want to sit at a grungy diner and just stare into their line. But although they're corporate, so they really do keep it clean. But also, you know, just as a lifelong cook, I sometimes get anxiety watching the cooks get slammed. And I'm like, I don't get why people want to do show kitchens. I want to look at the wall. But anyway, yeah. if you sit at the counter, they have their burgers in like 3-inch by 1-inch pucks. Okay. And I think it's so they don't break up because their burgers are so thin. And what they do is drop the burger on the griddle and then take one of those rigid burger spatulas and just take three quick swipes and smash it out.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit different than like pressing on it with a spatula. They put it down there, and these guys have done this 1,000 times, and they look good doing it too. They're just like, and it's just astounding how flat and even they can make a burger in just a couple of seconds.
Kind of like stucco in the side of a house or laying dry.
And they're as flat as a credit card. I mean, there's nothing to them. But they do this cool little swipe move. But that's an interesting topic because every burger type restaurant I've ever worked at, there have been people that always press the burger to make it cook faster. And there are people that never press the burger to make it cook faster and say that you shouldn't because you're going to crush the life out of it.
I like the smash like right in the beginning. That makes sense to me to like get more pan contact. I try not to press on it though, like even though it's so tempting. I really try not to. But if I feel like it needs to be like talked back down, like this is on a flat topper and a casty, obviously.
If it starts to hump up on you.
Yeah, just kind of just enough weight just to kind of talk it back down and just get more contact with
like
the cooking medium.
Like it's a piece of skin on trout.
Exactly, exactly. I try not to like squeeze the life out of it. But, you know, if it's well done or something and you're in a rush, like I'll throw a weight on it if I gotta. I'm not. But I try not to.
My thought on this issue is I actually get a quote, a culinary luminary that y'all might not have heard of. Kenny Shopson out of New York City. And he is just one of the best culinary minds this side of anywhere that has no reputation at all. But his quote on burgers, yes, on smashing burgers was, you know, it's like masturbating. I know you're not supposed to, but I like it.
Yeah, everyone wants to like push on the burger and like mush it down a little bit. It's hard.
The steam shoots out. You're like, yeah, you're cooking. And then also it makes the burger cook faster.
It does.
But
it does.
At what cost? I mean, you're probably...
I can't always say it's better for the burger or the end result, but I've never done a side-by-side.
I never have either. And we should do that. We should make this happen. What do you feel about grind size?
Well, you wanted to get it fine enough where you get that nice balance between crumble and stability for sure, but you don't want to smear it. I'm a proponent of like a medium die and like running it through twice.
Okay.
But also I like using brisket in my grind, top round or chuck. Like I just love brisket. I just really feel like the muscle fibers keep it, you know, that nice granular flavor, and you want to have cuts that like I get a lot of work to it. There's lots of myoglobin in there.
Well, yeah, brisket has an undeniably beefy flavor. Have you ever?
Yeah, you just want that iron rich cuts. Chuck flap is fantastic in it.
If I'm going to do a custom grinder at a restaurant, I actually even like running some through the large die.
Uh-huh.
And then mixing it into the stuff that's run through the medium die. You almost get like the steak tartareness where there's actual chunks. You get this much more organic feel for your burger. I understand it's not for everyone because there's going to be tough parts and there's going to be gristly parts. But if I encounter that in a burger, I am stoked.
Yeah, so that's a bonus for me. But most people in the grocery store, they want to see the pink paste, the hidden fat. Like, I just think that lean to fat ratio is key. In my opinion, you want it around 70-30.
Okay, yeah. You know? That was going to be my next question.
I like 70-30. I mean, 80-20.
And the thing is, yeah, your burgers cook down more, so you got to buy more. But you just make your burgers bigger.
So it's more delicious too.
And if you're, you know, a couple of gross blue collar thugs like Nate and I, that gives you more burger juice to dip your fries into.
Absolutely. more burger juice.
Which is a good case for the pan instead of the grill.
I take the more pan contact over the little bit of grill flavor it's going to pick up. Yeah, I like the smoked and the grilled flavor of it, you know, like best of both worlds, like how we used to smoke the fat and chill it down and grind it in there.
I forgot about that.
That was a sweet move.
That was a pain.
That was a lot of work though. And yeah, most people didn't even, man,
a lot of your sweet moves. A lot of your sweet moves are a lot of work, bro. I say this as your long time right hand man.
I know.
You know one thing I'm never gonna ask anybody to do ever? Pick grapefruit cells, you animal.
Yeah, it's easier with liquid nitrogen, but you know,
yeah,
pomelos are a little easier.
You told me about the liquid nitrogen thing and I was so mad. I was
Yeah.
Everyone Google grapefruit cells and then understand why. If I ever have a chance to stab Nate again, I will.
Keyword again.
You know what? You know how we like to open with a funny story? Let's do that. Yes. One next. Next.
How you stabbed me?
Next episode, how I stabbed Nate.
Okay. Yeah. You stabbed me. You stabbed me good.
That's one way of putting it.
I had nothing to do with it. It was completely innocent.
We're going to move right along. Back to tech tricks. One that I tried, I actually read about this in James Beard's American Cookery, which is a fantastic book. Like, I love it because, yes, it's comprehensive. It covers how to make basically every standard American dish. But also, he brings this sassy queen energy that's just great. Like, his recipe for gumbo says something like, here's a recipe for gumbo. I can't imagine why you want to make it. That's awesome. Like, it's fun to sit down and read. But his move was he would take a stick of butter and cut off a little slice of butter and then put that in the middle of his patty before pounding it flat. Now, this wouldn't work if you were going to do a medium rare burger or a medium burger, which, once again, I want to clarify, I've moved away from medium rare burgers, but I still like them. This wouldn't work in that. This is for a burger where the inside's going to be hot. So medium well plus. That slab of butter that's in there just soaks up all the flavor of the beef and gives you this little puck of fat that doesn't run into the grill. It stays right in the middle. And when you bite in, it's just absolutely nuts. It's just
I'm going to try that.
It is a beautiful technique. It actually kind of reminds me a little bit of, this should have been discussed back in the burger-like dishes, but are you familiar with the Juicy Lucy?
No. What is that?
It is.
Wait, is that another one of your toilet humor?
No. Not this time. It's not like the Algebra Test or the Deepwater Horizon. The Juicy Lucy is it's a burger variant that they do in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. My brother lives in St. Paul, and it is a burger stuffed with a big plug of American cheese and then cooked well done. So when you bite into it, you get this big burst of just liquefied American cheese, and it's so gross and so amazing. Like, remember our former coworker JD once described tater tot nachos as disgustingly awesome? That is definitely what a Juicy Lucy is. It is a disgustingly awesome burger variant. I have yet to make them at home. Perhaps I'll do a blog post on it. And the funny thing is, the first time I went, it was the kind of bar, I just wanted a beer. It was the kind of bar where the whole place you walk in and it just smells like rotten mop.
Shot mop.
It's the worst smell. But the thing is, I knew that that meant I was in a salt of the earth, blue collar type place where I wasn't going to get like some pretentious menu. I could just sit in the bar at 3 p.m. and slam a couple of pints of suds and not look like a scumbag. So that's exactly what I did. And so after a couple of beers, I wanted to see the menu, and I looked at it, and it had a Juicy Lucy section, but there was no information on the menu about what a Juicy Lucy was. So I was like, I will have a Juicy Lucy. And then she brings it to me, and it looks like a hamburger. And I'm like, what's going on here? And then I bit into it, and there was cheese all over my face and shirt. It's runny. I mean, it's American cheese. It pours like heavy cream when it's hot. Which, by the way, note that other cheese doesn't do that. That's how you know American cheese is not actually cheese. But I was in such a stressful place, and I was in such a bad mood, and that just gnarly, disgustingly awesome cheese-filled burger absolutely made my day.
I mean, even American cheese, and I use the word cheese lightly, has its place, you know?
It has its place.
The Kraft family made their fortune on that stuff.
You know, American cheese is, it's kind of wasted in a grilled cheese, but on a cheeseburger, it's good enough. You know, especially because what the cheese is there to do in a fast food burger is just mitigate the inferior quality of the meat. And absolutely, American cheese gets that job done. It gets it done.
100%. Yep. Gets the job done, my man.
You know, there's something to be said, though, for the fact that I'm from Central Illinois, and I grew up in a town that was surrounded on all sides by cornfields, and there was a Kraft plant in one of the cornfields. Now, I'm talking about the only kind of farms for 30 or 40 miles in any direction were corn and soybean farms. So okay, why would you put a cheese factory in the middle of a cornfield?
Bingo.
The answer is because powdered milk doesn't weigh as much as corn oil. So when your cheese is made of powdered milk and corn oil, it's easier to bring the powdered milk to the corn oil than to bring the corn oil to the powdered milk. We're starting to meander now, so I'm going to take us out of here. That concludes the first ever episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. Hope that all 11 of you enjoyed what you heard. You know, give us another listen.
Thanks for listening to our banter and sitting around getting fatter and fatter together.
So with that, we'll see you next time. Hot Dogs and Caviar. Once again, check out our blog, hotdogsandcaviar@blogspot.com.
All right, cheers, friends.
Yeah, cheers.
My little darling, my little sister.